Well, thank you, David, very much, and I would like to get a little copy of your introduction and carry it around with me, and it's very flattering and very kind, and I appreciate that. I want to extend my thanks this morning to Bill Campbell, particularly, and to really many others here for arranging for me to address you today. I count it a high honor to be on this panel and to have the opportunity to present my work to such a distinguished gathering. I read once that the measure of the success of a classroom experience is not how much the students learn, but how much the professor learns. And I hope today that the measure of the success of this panel will be how much I learn from all of you. I am presenting the outer shell, as it were, of my complete paper on Woodrow Wilson's Gospel of Service that lies at the heart of his idea of the American mission. The full text will be available on the website, and I really encourage comment, please. One further note, I have begun work on two larger projects. First, a comparative history of the idea of national mission from 1789 to 1914. And secondly, before I die, I would like to produce a larger project on the idea of mission as a persistent theme in Western civilization from Rome onward. Augustine's City of God identifies pride and humility as the founding principles of the city of God, man and the city of God, leaving no mystery as to the identity of the current embodiment of the arrogant city of man. Augustine quotes two significant lines from Virgil's Aeneid. The famous passage from Virgil's epic concerns Rome's perfection of the imperial arts and its boast of its unique, divinely appointed mission to beat down the proud. Throughout the Aeneid, Virgil reinforces Rome's historical mission. Father Jupiter himself had appointed Rome to found a universal, everlasting kingdom of peace, justice, and righteousness, leading history to its final destination, a new age of Saturn, in which the temple of war would be shut and law and order prevail throughout the inhabited world. In the City of God, however, Augustine seeks to undermine these pretensions. Humbling the proud is God's prerogative, not Rome's. It is a mission that Rome has falsely claimed as its own. Such grandiose aspirations made Rome nothing less than an impostor city of God, a sham eternal city, appropriating to itself the mission that belongs exclusively to Christ's kingdom, whose founder is not Aeneas, but God himself. To invest imperial Rome with the love and honor and worship due to God alone is, in Augustine's profound theological analysis, nothing less than idolatry. Rome, of course, has not been the only nation to succumb to the idolatry of empire, nor is the idea of national mission unique in Rome's successor empires in the West. Civilizations from the ancient world to the modern, whether European or Asian or American, Christian and non-Christian alike, have possessed a conviction of divine calling and destiny. Variations on this impulse have been evident in cultures as diverse as Confucian China, Hellenistic Greece, Augustan Rome, Ottoman Turkey, Romanov Russia, Victorian Britain, and Wilsonian America. America's own idea of mission has been woven out of Roman, Puritan, Enlightenment, Romantic nationalist, social gospel, and modern imperialist threads. And the sources of its images, symbols, metaphors, and vocabulary are, therefore, often difficult to untangle. Moreover, it has been shaped not only by its own historical experience, theological roots, and political ideology, but also by the expectations of outsiders, like the radicals of the French and English Enlightenment, who projected their unbounded hopes for universal redemption onto the emerging United States in the 1770s and 1780s. From the founding through the 19th century, the American people wrestled with various notions of mission, primarily between America as the New Eden and America as the New Israel, some would say, but really between both of these identities and America as the Christ nation. By the end of the 19th century, however, the decision had largely been made in favor of America as the Christ nation. Indeed, by the 1890s, according to Walter McDougall, the world redemptive mission of America had clearly triumphed over the older ideal of American exceptionalism and neutrality. While not using the precise term Christ nation, McDougall perceptively divided the history of American foreign policy into an Old Testament of prudent exceptionalism and self-restraint, and a New Testament of ideological interventionism and missionary zeal. America's leaders embraced a crusading foreign policy in 1898, quote, whereupon they began to draft a New Testament that did admonish Americans to go forth and do good among nations. Woodrow Wilson inherited, but also helped transform, the complex idea of American mission. He was transfixed by the allure of a national mission, and variations on this theme dominated his speeches. His sense of divine calling has generally been attributed to his Puritan and Calvinist upbringing, rich sources indeed for the idea of a chosen people and a national covenant. But his public utterances are also filled with ideas and language much closer to revolutionary France, to 19th century romantic nationalism, and to the contemporary social gospel's fusion of the spheres of church and state and of the realms of the city of God and the city of man. There is, in Wilson's vision of destiny, as much of Giuseppe Mazzini's millennial kingdom of world association as there is of John Winthrop's city on a hill. Armed with these principles, Wilson moved America away from thinking of itself simply as a new Eden or a new Israel toward the romantic, progressive, social gospel ideal of America as the Christ nation. Under Wilson's direction, the revolution in U.S. foreign policy was secured. During World War I, the American urge to wage wars of deliverance overwhelmed the previous orthodoxy of American separatism and non-interventionism. Departing from the founder's idea of mission, Wilson perpetuated the messianic impulse of romantic nationalism evident in revolutionary France, the first of the modern Christ nations, as Irving Babbitt pointed out in the context of the First World War. Wilson dedicated American foreign policy to the moralizing, redemptive uplift of humanity and to the gospel of service, rejecting any taint of selfishness and any motive of fear, national glory, or material interests. His presidency, therefore, clearly marks a turning point in U.S. history. Under Wilson, America lost its will to restrain the redemptive interventionist impulse to be the Christ nation. To be sure, that self-discipline had been impaired by the crusading temperament of the 1890s, but it was destroyed by the Wilsonian gospel of service. In the 1930s, historian Albert Weinberg cut through Wilson's humanitarian imperialism and ethical interventionism to see the danger he posed to any sense of limits in foreign policy. Thinking primarily of Wilson's intervention in Latin America and in the Caribbean, Weinberg wrote that, quote, "The most radical imperialist is apt to be the one most devoted to liberty. His exalted moral consciousness may destroy conscience itself, in the sense that it removes all sense of limitations upon the means of attaining an ideal. Imperialism is even less troubling to the ethical interventionist than to the ethical expansionist, the former being reassured by the assumption that his infringement of sovereignty is but a temporary inconsistency, which will eventuate in greater democracy," end quote. Despite Weinberg's caution, some of the best-known studies of the idea of mission in American history have failed to see an outward-directed mission as dangerous. Edward McNall Burns's Cold War-era treatment of the idea of mission in American history, while critical of the uses made of American mission, did not see it as inherently dangerous. Rather, it needed only to be channeled intelligently, humanely, and productively. The impulse to spread liberty, equality, democracy, and peace to humanity was still valid and appropriate in the 1950s. But while Burns called for America to lead the way to humanitarian interventionism, he was enough of a realist to recognize that, quote, Internationalism in this country has commonly taken the form of interventionism. Frederick Merck, writing soon after Burns and drawing on his work, distinguished between manifest destiny and mission, seeing manifest destiny as embodying the spirit of conquest, while depicting mission as alien to imperialism and simply reflecting the impulse, quote, to redeem the old world by high example, end quote. He rightly interpreted mission as helping to propel Congress toward intervention in Europe in 1917, but overall saw the spirit of intervention as consistent with an inspiring, idealistic, and selfless mission in contrast to the crude grasping of manifest destiny. But this distinction is far too tidy. As Lee Tubison correctly pointed out in his superb book, Redeemer Nation, mission is a complex and self-contradictory idea, and it was often linked in the American mind with continental expansion and imperialism. Tubison discerned two competing expressions of the American mission, the vision of America as a new Eden destined to lead the world by example, and of America as a militant millennialist new Israel destined to build a righteous kingdom through righteous conquest. This distinction is helpful. But even the phrase New Israel does not capture the shift in America's self-understanding after the 1890s that came with overseas empire and was then affixed to the national consciousness with intervention in World War I, namely the messianic social gospel vision of America as the Christ nation. In the spirit of romantic nationalists like Mazzini, who sacralized the modern nation-state by transferring to it the whole vocabulary of the church and redemption, Wilson reassigned the divine attributes of Christ to the American nation. The U.S. was the mediator, the suffering servant, the light of the world, the deliverer, the peacemaker, the bringer of salvation. Tragically, the United States was not the only nation or empire to define itself in such transcendent terms by the time of the Great War. The same language and temperament was evident in many nations prior to 1914 and helped prepare the imagination of the West for total war. No one can reasonably deny that modern industrial technology made possible the scale of destruction and loss of life in the First World War. But what must also be understood, however, is how the great powers, including the United States, had the capacity of will to use this technology against each other. An ungoverned sense of mission may be part of the explanation for this unbridled willingness. At the deepest spiritual level, mission may help account for the magnitude of the Great War. At the very least, it is the key to the spiritual core of the war. The pervasive sense of mission in Europe and America may have intensified and protracted the Great War. As an abstract Manichaean conflict between good and evil, light and dark, redemption and perdition, the Great War fed on each combatant's exaggerated national self-image, twisted caricature of the enemy, inflated meaning of the war, and unlimited promises for the outcome of the battle. A comprehensive comparative analysis of the idea of mission in the century leading up to the First World War is needed to understand the extent to which mission helped cause the war, or more likely, helped intensify the war. All of these competing missions seem to have been, to a greater or less degree, a distortion, secularization, or in Wilson's case, a Gnostic hyper-spiritualization of the authentic Christian mission, the evangelical duty to advance the kingdom of God. But it may turn out that the doctrinal content of these various competing national creeds was less important than the fact of the existence of competing missions in the first place. That is, of the breakup of mission, whether ancient Roman or Christian or both, into rival missions, plural. It may matter less what each of the great powers believed or said it was doing than the fact that each nation was, in Irving Babbitt's phrase, living expansively, without restraint on appetite, beautiful souls locked in mortal combat to realize their separate missions of world redemption. 1,600 years ago, St. Augustine warned against the inherent idolatry of empire. To assign to one's earthly nation the mission that by right belongs only to the kingdom of Christ is to be guilty of the worst of disordered loves. If every nation is Rome, then every opponent is Carthage awaiting destruction, and every battle a heroic campaign to destroy the last impediment to imperial destiny. If every nation is the church, then every opponent is a heretic or infidel, and every engagement a crusade for orthodoxy or for the liberation of the Holy Land. If every nation is the city of God, the new Jerusalem come down out of heaven, then every enemy is the Babylonian whore, and every victory a defeat for the city of man. If every great power is the Christ nation, then every adversary is Satan and every battle Armageddon. Under these conditions, no limits, no compromise, no negotiation is possible. Each nation obeys its own great commission to go into all the world and preach its gospel and to make disciples of every nation, even if it means baptizing them in blood. Woodrow Wilson mentally inhabited an impossible place and tried to wage war to achieve an impossible peace for that impossible place. He sought finality, perfect resolution, permanence, and universality in a world of contingency, conflict, disappointment, transience, and boundaries. He sought to redeem the world by universalizing the American principles of consent of the governed, self-determination, and democracy, and he delegitimized any government that did not share these ideals. Since Wilson's time, the American mission has become in some ways even more abstract, attenuated, vague, and secularized. Now we are told that America is an idea, as if that fragment of mission alone can explain and justify any military action around the globe. But is there an idea of mission that is not idolatrous or that is not the product of a diseased imagination? If so, then this is the only kind of mission worth salvaging and reviving. Perhaps that mission is the more modest hope of the founders that America would serve as an example of successful self-government, prospering under the rule of law, protected by a constitutional regime of limited and defined powers, skeptical of the lovers of humanity, and unembarrassed by a foreign policy based on national interests. Thank you.